its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Full funding for MSU's FRIB project is included in an appropriations bill before the U.S. Congress. That would be $55 million requested by Senator Stabenow and Senator Levin. It could be voted on as early as next week, according to Paul Henderson's story at LSJ.com. Later on this hour, we talk about a new report exploring what America's water infrastructure needs. The report claims we lose 6 billion gallons of treated water a day in this country. Danielle Gallet joins us from the Center for Neighborhood Technology. But first,
well, she had this image, this grandmotherly, you know, just wonderful. And she was a grandma. She was wonderful. But she was also steel.
That's former Governor John Engler remembering his lieutenant governor for two terms, Connie Binsfeld, who died Sunday at the age of 89. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta covered Connie Binsfeld in the state Senate and then as lieutenant governor. And Susan Demas, an MLive columnist and publisher of the Inside Michigan Politics newsletter, both join us to remember the legacy of Connie Binsfeld. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Remind us who Connie Binsfeld was. She's been out of the loop here for a little while. What put her first on the political map here in Michigan?
Well, I there are a few different ways to look at it. One is certainly that she was the first woman to serve as in both the Michigan House and the Michigan Senate, as well as lieutenant governor. You know, but I think maybe even more significant than that is, you know, a lieutenant governor, the job doesn't have much of a description other than presiding over sessions of the state Senate. So the position is what the lieutenant governor makes of it and what the governor allows the lieutenant governor to make of it. And and Connie Binsfeld was a lieutenant governor of consequence, that she took a big interest particularly in children's issues. And, you know, the things that she worked on remain state policies to this day in terms of the ability of authorities to become engaged in troubled families where children are being abused or neglected. And the state policy that says that there was, during the Engler years, there was a rift within the administration about what to do when families are troubled like that. Do you take the children out and immediately just place them with another, you know, in state custody or with another family never to return? Or do you try and do something to repair these families and eventually bring them back together and restore the parental rights? And Connie Binsfeld thought that it was both the right thing for children and the practical thing to do was the latter. Right. And so the state's, you know, basically governing policy that, you know, wherever possible we try to repair these families, that was the direct result of the work of Connie Binsfeld. And that's just, you know, one thing. You go back to her legislative career and, you know, you look at a lot
started serving in 74, mm-hmm, so she goes mm-hmm back a ways.
You know, and, you know, she was very active in the environmental bond legislation that created all kinds of cleanup projects, some of them that are you know, still continuing to this day, that she was instrumental in passing the Michigan Sand Dune Protection Act, the one that says that – the one that codified in law the idea that it's kind of stupid to build something on the face of a dune on the Great Lakes, that she was engaged in that. I mean, this was a career that we're seeing the legacy play out to this day. Mm.
She was still considered, though it's being reported, she was considered a surprise pick.
Yes.
By John Engler in 1990. Why?
Well, I guess let's place it in the context of the times, that, you know, typically, and Susan, you can jump in on this, that ticket balancing is something where you try and find someone who brings something that – you don't. If your reputation is being, you know, in the center, you want someone who's maybe brings, you know,
more of the base.
More of the base. If you're from one part of the state, maybe you want to find someone from another population
sure.
center, you know, things like that. If you have one type of experience, well, when Rick Snyder was choosing his lieutenant governor, Susan, he chose Brian Kelly because
he had legislative experience, which Rick Snyder did not. So he was able to bring that to the ticket. And oftentimes, especially for the Democratic Party, they do look and they do want a female candidate if the male is at the top of the ticket. Republicans aren't quite so concerned about that usually. But, you know, she was a historic choice to bring that to the ticket, especially at a time when Governor Jim Blanchard had dropped Martha Griffiths, who was his lieutenant governor pick, who was a woman.
Who was given a lot of credit for giving him credibility when he was a member of Congress running, that she was really an iconic figure in national Democratic politics as
yes.
well as Michigan Democratic politics. And the Blanchard administration decided that it was time for her to go, but no one told her.
Right. And so for Engler to do this, it was a very Engler-esque move, very canny to choose a woman, and a woman who had achieved so much already and who he had worked with so closely in the Senate. She didn't bring the ticket balancing in terms – you know, she also –
They were both from the legislature.
She was not from population centers.
She's
she was from Traverse
more.
City,
mm-hmm.
and he was from Beale City. But looking back – It was an excellent choice, and people really respected it. Engler was a person who was not afraid to break the rules, and it's probably one reason why he was able to achieve that surprise election.
What's the sense from folks up at the Capitol remembering Connie Bensfeld now?
There, because of term limits, there aren't that many who do.
Right.
But, you know,
maybe their fathers remembered her.
Yeah. yeah. Connie's nickname, and she was aware of it, was Mrs. Butterworth, because she sort of had that grandma thing, you know, going.
Matronly.
Yeah, and she never, at least in my experience, she never got visibly angry, but she did have a small smile to be feared. Because she was actually a very canny political player, that she knew how to maneuver through the shoals of politics and policymaking and get her way, and she would best some pretty seasoned smart players, including on occasion the person who would become or was her boss, John Engler.
Yeah.
We should also say that Engler observed there was one other thing that attracted her to the ticket, which was, at the time, he was very, very much an underdog, and he said, well, she actually thought we could win this, and so that added points as well.
We're talking with the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta and Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics about the late Lieutenant Governor Connie Bensfeld. Have political divisions intensified at the Capitol since she served as LG? Does she already belong to a different era?
I would say yes. I mean, certainly she served in the legislature pre-term limits. She was known for working with Democrats on legislation, even though she was certainly a conservative. Nowadays, it's very hard to build relationships. There's very little bipartisanship to be had. And, you know, given this context, it would be very difficult to see a Connie Bensfeld today.
Although it's kind of funny, you look at the difficulties that this governor has had with, you know, the International Bridge in Detroit, mm-hmm. with road funding, with the Medicaid expansion, which is not entirely done, that,
right.
You know, Rick Snyder could certainly use a Connie Bensfeld.
Absolutely. And
did she successfully soften the perception of Governor Engler?
No.
That is part of this equation, though. That is part.
I think I would disagree. I think she did with the female vote. I do. You know, she was very focused on children's issues, on domestic violence. Those are issues that currently Republicans don't talk a lot about. But during that era, she made very significant changes in those areas, and I think that was appealing to suburban women.
It may have been. I just don't think that there you could really soften John Engler's image. But she did, in her own right, bring those things that Susan is talking about, you know, to the table, and you know, perhaps in a way that they wouldn't have been otherwise. And certainly, I don't know about to the rest of Michigan, but certainly to the culture in Lansing, she brought a lot of credibility to those questions because of her work on them.
Moving on, while I have you both here, let's talk a little bit about the State of the State speech coming up on Thursday. Any particular expectations here? Is the governor apt to mention the budget surplus and how that ought to be spent? Is this the forum for a comment on the budget surplus?
I imagine that it will be mentioned but not dwelled upon, in part because that will be dealt with more substantially in early February with the rollout of the state budget. But I mean, he will want to claim it as
a result
as an
policy.
Indicator of success. Yeah.
And Susan Demas, in your latest MLive column, I'd like to ask you a question about that. You write that in the State of the State, Governor Snyder, quote, needs to plot his own comeback. What do you mean?
Well, he has had a lot of successes, but he's also had a bumpy ride, especially with his own party as of late. You know, the Medicaid expansion was overall a success, although it was delayed, but he had to fight tooth and nail for that. Road funding, he's gotten nowhere on it with his party, and that was at the top of the list for his last State of the State. That's certainly not something that he wants to walk into an election year not being able to claim any victory on. And you also have this budget surplus, which, you know, is kind of an instance of more money, more problems. Now you have his own party undoing part of his 2011 tax reform, which included keeping the state income tax rate at 4.25%. They see money in the bank and they want to give it back to taxpayers as it's an election year. But, you know, Governor Snyder has said that that's a fine place to leave it, and that helps balance out all of the business tax cuts that were passed. So in his State of the State, he needs to reestablish himself as the leader of the Republican Party, not somebody that they run roughshod over.
You know, it'll be sort of interesting that he's going to use this to make the case for his reelection, although it will have to be oblique and subtle. But I'm wondering, who will he be making that case to? Will it be to the Republican base that he needs to secure, or will it be to the more independent voters? You know, you go back to his first State of the State address as governor. That was an address that was so centrist in its themes that it almost demanded a Republican response. and so it'll be interesting to see, which side of Rick Snyder we see in this particular address.
It's interesting, since we're talking about the Engler administration, though, clearly the one of the great divides is that the executive then was part of the base, and today the executive is the man in the middle.
And that is a huge change.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
So. Although I wonder where John Engler controlled the Republican Party in Michigan in a way that Rick Snyder just does not. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, he seems to find the party aspects, the partisan aspects of holding political office to seem sort of tawdry.
There's no way that a John Engler would have tolerated the sideshow that National Committeeman Dave Ejima has become.
No.
But Rick Snyder seems to, not want to wade into that territory very much.
Yeah. Rick Pluta is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Susan Demas is a columnist for MLive and the publisher of the Inside Michigan Politics newsletter. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Stakeholders in the Lansing School District are weighing in on a new plan to adapt the district's buildings and properties to the needs of the new century. A 14-member facilities task force, led by our next guest, has been at work since October. Key recommendations in its final report include repurposing a host of district buildings, consideration of a bond proposal to update Pattengill Middle School into a high school, and the sale of over 100 acres of vacant land. The recommendations come after years of challenges for the district, which has been hit hard by dwindling enrollment, declining revenue, and low test scores. Here to talk about the task force's final report and recommendations, Co-Chair Kelly Dean. Hi, Kelly.
Mark, good morning. Glad to be with you this morning.
Last October, Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul told the State Journal that, quote, their goal is to talk about what we need to create a new high school for the Lansing School District, unquote. Are you recommending that Pattengill Junior High School become that new high school?
Well, Mark, a lot went into an evaluation to get to the point of making that particular recommendation, which is to repurpose the current Pattengill Middle School Academy into a high school. And you may be aware that, our group has put a tremendous amount of effort into this decision, but also include some other very specialized type recommendations that be glad to share with you.
And we will move on to some of those other recommendations here in just a minute. For starters, though, Kelly, tell us why converting or expanding Pattengill Junior High into a new high school makes for a good plan.
Well, you know, that was one of the very last recommendations that we made, Mark, but the purpose of the use of Pattengill, it is Lansing's last building that was, it's the newest, the last facility to be built in the district. A lot of thought and effort went into the design and construction location, and all of those areas still fit in our decision. And we are aware of the fact that that building is designed well enough that it can be expanded into the type of high school that we believe is needed on the east side of the city of Lansing. And so with all that said, we felt it was the most reasonable, the most cost-effective, and the very best decision of Lansing to achieve having a new building that we believe our students need, and at the same time continue to use Everett High School on the south end of town, and with some renovations to that particular building so that we have two 21st century buildings ready to provide 21st century education to our kids.
How much diversity, I mean, you were one of 14 members on this facilities task force.
Yes.
How much diversity of opinion was there among the other members on the task force?
You know, a tremendous amount. Good discussion. Very, very detailed, heated discussion. And heated in that solid discussion that took all aspects of our decisions into account.
Heated in a good way?
in a good way. You know, this would have easily, Mike, I want to say for anyone that I wouldn't personally know is that I spent 15 years in the school district as a first as a teacher's aide, went back to Michigan State and completed my degrees in education and taught, and it was an administrator in Lansing schools for 15 years. So I have a real personal passion for the Lansing schools. And our state capital, our urban district that we have deserves the best for all of our kids. And I believe that passion it was true with all of the members. Every segment of the community, I really believe, had representation. A lot of discussion went into The fact of the truly historical buildings that we have between Lansing Eastern and Lansing Sexton in particular.
What would happen there, Kelly? What would happen? Tell us a little bit about what you've got in mind for Sexton and Eastern.
Mark, and this is easily just to talk about facilities. We spent a lot of time in a very, very quality time talking about how do we develop the right spaces for kids to learn. It's not about bricks and mortars as much as what do we do to help enhance, as I've said, and Superintendent Yvonne Kamau-Kanul will tell you, a 21st century learning environment. And we said, you know, our kids need careers. They need preparation. They need readiness. They need careers. They need opportunities for their lives. And so the best example to start with is Lansing Eastern. Sparrow Hospital and Lansing School District have continued to partner in various ways, and our solid recommendation is that we continue to expand that partnership and Lansing Eastern become a specialized high school that would prepare young folks in the area of medical careers. You know, and you think about medical careers, there's all different levels, you know, from a person learning technical abilities all the way to advanced medicine research and maybe becoming doctors and nurses. And this is the place that we believe that with that medical partnership with Sparrow right next door would develop that business and educational partner. Sexton High School has a long history in the area of engineering, preparing engineers, and we would want to continue that in working in the STEM development programs with math and science, including engineering. We suggested robotics and other very specialized programs that would help enhance our kids to prepare to be ready and also to be able to move on for not only advanced vocational development as well as 2 and 4 year degrees.
There's some number of people. We're talking with Kelly Dean, who co-chaired the recent Lansing School District Facilities Task Force plotting the future of the district's buildings and property here for the 21st century. There's some number of people, Kelly, who seem unable to take any proposal seriously that does not involve closing a building, often closing a high school completely. What do you make of that criticism?
Well, you know, if you looked at the numbers of students that we have right now, there's no question that that we could demonstrate that Lansing Eastern presently is full. Lansing Sexton may have some capacity, but it is absolutely necessary to have three building high schools at the present time. And we believe that going forward, that's what's still going to be needed for the district. We have also recommended in our repurposing, for example, that there are other services within the Lansing school district that could be developed and or moved. You have to look at the whole picture. For example, we're recommending the closure of the administration building, which is on Kalamazoo Street downtown. We believe that building proximity of state capitol and other potential uses of that facility downtown are very important. So the administration building would need to move to some location.
Was there a lot of diversity on your task force regarding closing a school? Did you have really vocal proponents for closing one of the major buildings?
You know, we did not. In particular, in this particular group, we really did not, because we looked at the entire district. There are obvious areas there that we recommended that property need to be sold. Other businesses need other buildings needed to be sold. We're in the process of we recommended the hiring of real estate experts and others first to get appraisals, et cetera, to really downsize the district to where it's located, to where that it is more financially responsible to its constituents. But when we get back to the high schools again, no, there's a very strong feeling that that these two facilities need to be repurposed. And for example, I said the administration, for example, it would make a lot of sense to our committee that the district consider moving all the administration from downtown to the Sexton Building and reusing a portion of the building for the centralized administration, as well as expanding the service, the particular curriculum there in the engineering and in math areas. We really believe that that this particular focus on these specialized schools would not only support a really specific area of the 21st century learning for our Lansing kids, but will be an attraction for other students, that the idea of choice needs to be promoted for the district for other students who would and other families and students who have an interest in staying in the city or moving back to the city.
Kelly, it's been less than a year since the city's financial health team made recommendations involving the school district, and those included sharing some real estate with the city. Did you look at those?
Yes, that is certainly always an option that will be that is there and on the table, and that is something that certainly that the school board is always able to look at. Yes.
But did you make a recommendation that played off any of those financial health team recommendations in your final report?
There is not a specific that I recall right at the moment, but we certainly that we are very aware of their report and so on, and we really felt that if there was an opportunity, that's certainly open for discussion.
You took tours of East Lansing and Holt High Schools as part of this process. What was the takeaway from those visits?
We found those very, very rewarding for our group to be able to get a good perspective. I also need to mention that we traveled to Jackson, and we looked at their single high school, which is about the same age as Lansing Eastern High School. And we've looked from boiler rooms to swimming pools to learning labs and computer rooms, libraries, auditoriums, every aspect of those. And what we took away was that, you know, Holt, for example, is a beautiful facility, brand new single high school, one high school. You know, it would be nice to have facilities like that. But it was when a final outcome came, it said that, you know, the size of Lansing and so on, that we needed at least two to three facilities on each side of our city to be able to provide a proper service rather than one mega high school.
We've got less than a minute, Kelly, and I have to ask you what the response has been to your plan so far from the board, from the administration, from families, from everybody. Characterize that for us.
So far, I believe it to be very positive. I believe it to be very positive. I believe it to be very responsible for the district, responsible to the taxpayers, responsible in that. We're addressing as much the ability to help kids learn and be able to prepare for careers as much as just room and space. Proper use of existing facilities, expanding on our best assets.
Okay.
And moving from there. And
we need to let it go there, Kelly. We appreciate your time very much. Kelly Dean has been co-chair of the 14-member Lansing School District Facilities Task Force, which filed its report recently. Kelly, thank you.
You're very welcome, Mark.
current state on 90.5 WKAR. In the Great Lakes region, we are protective of our water. Concern has been expressed over low lake levels, the amount of water being used for fracking and diverting water to Waukesha, Wisconsin, but little is known about the loss of treated water in the region. According to a report by the Center for Neighborhood Technology, every day nearly 6 billion gallons of treated water is lost across America. Danielle Gallet is the Water Supply Program Manager at the Center for Neighborhood Technology and one of the report's authors. Danielle, welcome to Current State.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
6 billion gallons of water is a mind-bending amount of water. Can you give us some context for just exactly how much water that is?
Absolutely. And actually, it's 66.5 billion gallons of water per year. That could fill Willis Tower in Chicago about 16 times. It could put the city of Detroit under about 70 feet of water. But maybe the most revealing factoid about 66.5 billion gallons of water is that it could provide 1.9 million Americans with their potable water service needs for a year.
Okay, let's get our figures straight here. You're saying 66.5 billion gallons of water a year.
Yes, in the Great Lakes state.
That is
an estimate.
In the Great Lakes state, and that is an estimate. Why are we losing so much treated water?
It's a great question. One of the major components of that is that we have been enjoying an infrastructure system that was either put in about a century ago or post-World War II. And a lot of the infrastructure that's buried beneath our feet, kind of out of sight, out of mind, is coming to the end of its useful life and starting to crumble. So we are in what the water industry considers the replacement era of water service infrastructure. So we're starting to see water loss on the rise within these systems.
And has consumption at the same time gone up? What's happened there?
Well, luckily enough, the trends across the nation are that potable water use per capita is actually trending down.
Hmm.
And a lot of this is due to more efficient use of the water, as well as new and improved technologies for that. However, the loss in the systems is continuing to trend up.
And how do we monitor the infrastructure exactly? What monitoring process might we put into place?
So the International Water Association and the American Water Works Association have created a fairly robust water loss auditing process that currently exists and is considered a best practice in the industry. This methodology, they've actually created a free online software that is available to any utility, whether they are a member of these agencies or not, because they feel the importance of this is so crucial to the industry today. And so this type of monitoring would allow utilities to begin processing the amount of water that they send out into the distribution system, what the collection rate on the billed amount of water that was sent out is, and where the discrepancies between those two numbers are. And then when we do that, then we can start to look at, in the system, implementing leak detection programs, implementing metering inaccuracy detection, and a host of other suite of best practices that do exist in the industry. And this would help the utilities to better prioritize and understand the specifics of what kind of water loss type they're having in their system.
Is there buy-in among utilities in general for this online monitoring approach?
In general, those that know about it are generally supportive of it. However, one of the most interesting facts about water service is that we have over 54,000 water supply utilities operating in the United States today. And so word of mouth and getting this out to the industry and rolling out those trainings is what the challenge is. So this report is both to bring light and amplify the issue, but also to call for resources to be able to roll out education and awareness to all these utilities in order to be able to ramp up on these best practices.
We're talking to Danielle Gallet, who is the Water Supply Program Manager at the Center for Neighborhood Technology, about all of the water that she finds is being lost among water that is being retreated across America. Are we literally talking leaky pipes here? Is it largely no more complicated than that, or is it?
It's a bit more complicated than that, unfortunately. There are two types of water loss when we're talking about water loss in a system. The first one is real losses in water systems, and that's the one that you're touching on as far as pipeline leakages, water main leaks and breaks, actual leakage in the system. The second type of water loss is what's referred to as apparent loss, which is incurred on the metering and accuracy side of things. So for, say, a meter that maybe hasn't been upgraded recently within the past 20 to 30 years, for every 2 gallons that pass the meter, only 1 gallon is read. And so we're not actually accounting for the full amount of water passing into the system. Both of these have an impact to the utility as well as the society.
What does fixing the leaks, the actual leaks, what does that look like?
So actual leaks, it could be from anything as invasive as having to tear up roads and replace pipe to going to new lining. Oftentimes, if it's a small leak, simply rejigging the pressure management of that area of the system can allow for that much less leakage to be happening, which sometimes is more economically viable for the situation.
How expensive are these fixes in general, though?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, because we don't have the robust data coming in on how much leakage is actually happening and actual leakage fixes happening out there in the industry, it's very hard to specify. It's very circumstantial to the utility, the scale of the municipality it's servicing. There's a number of different factors out there. But I will say it is not necessarily cheap if we're talking about tearing up roads and replacing pipes.
Now, since water and energy are linked, Danielle, how would the changes in water infrastructure impact energy costs?
Oh, absolutely. This is a great question. So, as you kind of alluded to, the relationship between water and energy is very profound. It takes an amazing amount of water to produce energy, and it takes an amazing amount of energy to produce water, potable water, to us. It's estimated that about 75% of the cost of municipal water processing and distribution is electricity alone. So by reducing the leaks, we reduce water production costs as well as energy usage, which is what we all would like to see is more energy efficiency happening.
Proponents of greater investment in infrastructure point to benefits in the job market as well. Explain that, please.
Absolutely. Investments in water as well as other infrastructure are one of the best ways to create jobs. Dollar for dollar, infrastructure investments can create about 40% more jobs than across-the-board tax cuts and over 5 times more jobs than temporary business tax cuts. And it's interesting to note also that the U.S. Department of Commerce, their Bureau of Economic Analysis, estimates that for every job added in the water workforce, 3.68 jobs are added to the national economy.
Hmm. How interesting. Now, the report calls on the Great Lakes region to lead this effort in transforming water infrastructure and auditing. Why the Great Lakes region?
It's a great question. I would say that we're better to demonstrate good stewardship than here in the Great Lakes states, where we enjoy the world's largest available amount of fresh water. It's also interesting to note that this region is also an economic powerhouse in the country. 30% of the nation's gross domestic product is produced here, and 60% of all U.S. manufacturing is based here. So this region is really being positioned as a world water hub, given the amount of vast water resources that we enjoy. And robust practices in water loss control within these states would just further demonstrate this leadership of the region. And I would say as one who is someone who's enjoyed living by the Great Lakes my whole entire life and of other people that I know, we very much value this resource and hold it in high esteem. And what greater place to demonstrate leadership than right here?
Danielle Gallet is the Water Supply Program Manager at the Center for Neighborhood Technology. Their report is called The Case for Fixing the Leaks. This environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news on the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. Danielle Gallet, good luck and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
comedian Mike Birbiglia returns to Wharton Center this Thursday. He's known for his work on This American Life, his movie called Sleepwalk With Me, and many more comedy records and appearances. His latest show is called Thank God for Jokes. And Current State's Melissa Benmark got to talk to Mike Birbiglia a few weeks ago. Hi, Melissa. What was this like?
Oh, Mark, he has got to be up there with in the top three most fun people to talk to ever. I mean,
great.
he's like your best friend, your funniest best friend.
Okay.
And he was here, actually. He likes Michigan. He likes touring in Michigan. He's starting his tour out here. And the last time I talked to him was February of 12 when he was last at Wharton Center. And at that time, I found out that the only thing that he has – more passion for than comedy is pizza. Wanted to open a pizza parlor since he was 8 years old. So this time when I talked to him, I had to ask his opinion on a trendy new pizza ingredient, Brussels sprouts.
I will protest that to the end. I will be picketing in the streets, Brussels sprouts pizza.
Good for you.
It just takes, I feel like you're shooting pizza in the foot with that one. You're not helping pizza soar and feel better about itself. You're reminding it of the health value it doesn't have.
One thing I wanted to ask you, you're starting out this tour in Traverse City.
In Michigan?
In Michigan. This never happens to us. This is so cool.
I know. What have I done? And not only that, I'm starting in Traverse City. It's like what comedian goes on tour and says, I am starting my 100 city tour in Traverse City, Michigan. Woo! I love Traverse City. I love Lansing and in Royal Oak. But I think that's part of the reason it's been so popular so far. And it seems like these shows are going to be packed. The Traverse City show is about to sell out, and the Lansing one is going to be packed, and Royal Oak is almost sold out. And I think it's honestly, people just want to go somewhere. They need to go somewhere. And so if it's as cold as it is, then I think that you're ahead of the game. It's a good selling point. It's a bold weather choice for me to make.
A bold weather choice.
It is a bold weather choice, yeah.
So I was doing a little research on your upcoming show and saw the first line of some article that described you as America's favorite sleepwalker. Of course, associated with the
movie. I love that, yeah.
Sleepwalk sure. With me. But, I mean, seriously, how does that happen when you've got a particular story or several that's really strongly associated with you? How do you get people to kind of move on from that?
It's so strange. You know, it's like my new special, which is on Netflix and iTunes and everything, it's called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. And it is all about how I decided to get married despite not believing in the idea of marriage. It's really kind of this elaborate rant about marriage and how I don't believe in it, and then ultimately the events that led me to get married. And it's actually, you know, it's based on a piece that I did originally on This American Life called Return to the Scene of the Crime, where I was hit by a drunk driver and made to pay for the drunk driver's car, and about how I was obsessed with being right. And thematically, it's tied into the thing with marriage of being obsessed with being right, and that marriage doesn't make sense, and here's all the reasons and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. I think ultimately, over time, I think between My Girlfriend's Boyfriend and Thank God for Jokes and all the other things that I plan to do in the future, I think over time that'll fall away. I do think in the short term, it's like, you know, I had a movie that was seen by, you know, probably 3 or 4 million people around the world. And so, and it's called Sleepwalk With Me. So inevitably people are going to be like the guy, you know, the guy who sleepwalks.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, so, yeah, I get that a lot. Everyone's favorite sleepwalking comedian, like as though that who I am, like I walk around in pajamas holding a teddy bear,
right.
You know,
right.
Everywhere I go.
It's like Larry the Cable Guy coming out and saying, get her done, and then saying, okay, pay me my money, I'm done.
Yeah, I feel like people, if that's what they're expecting, they're going to be gravely disappointed in the show. I don't even talk, I mean, what's funny is these publications saying, everyone's favorite sleepwalking comedian, I come to town, I'm not going to tell that story, I have all new story.
This will be a 100% sleepwalking free show.
Exactly.
Well, tell us a little bit about it. Tell us about the process of putting it together. I mean, you don't just like write a script and then just do the script at all of the show. I mean, how does something like this come together?
I've been writing this show over the course of about 2 years. I do these little shows off the radar called, I call them Working It Out. And it's I do them at the Cherry Lane Theater in New York and Union Hall, which is actually the place where, in Sleepwalk With Me, my character, Matt Pandemiglio, is a bartender at the Union Hall. And I write a lot of stuff, and I put it on stage, and the stuff that I always say at the end of the shows, you know, thanks for coming out. If, you know, you'll come see this in 6 months, and it'll be different, and you'll go, that's funnier, and that's funnier, and that's better. And then inevitably, you'll go, what about that bit? What about that story? Where's that? And the answer is that it's gone, and the reason is because of you. And I want you to think about that, and because it's true. Like, I put tons of stuff in front of audiences, and if it doesn't work, it just goes away. I mean, it's just like trial. It's just a trial and error. It's the thing about stand-up that you can't get away from, no matter how much success you've had, is that there's just failure in it. There's just a ton of failure to get to the stuff that really, really works.
Well, and that whole narrative of the people who do stand-up saying that there's this agonizing period of time where you just feel about 2 inches tall because about half of what you do, maybe, you know, just nobody laughs. Nobody gets it.
Yeah, because audiences don't lie, you know, especially comedy audiences. They laugh or they don't laugh. And laughing, I think, is a real visceral response. It's a very physical thing. I mean, that's actually one of the reasons the show's called Thank God for Jokes, is that the theme that emerged when I was working out all of these jokes is my initial impulse was I wanted to kind of return to form in terms of my first album. My four albums to date are Two Drink Mike from 2006, and then My Secret Public Journal Live, and then Sleepwalk With Me Live, and then My Girlfriend's Boyfriend Live, which just came out this year. And I wanted to get back to Two Drink Mike, which was like all jokes and stories. And the title bit from that one is that when I drink, I don't drink a lot because when I drink, I become another person. Like, Two Drink Mike loves dancing and knows a magic trick. Zero Drink Mike enjoys biographies and has serious opinions about wildlife. Five Drink Mike enjoys dancing with wildlife. And so I always had this dream, like, wouldn't it be funny if I released an album called Five Drink Mike? And it was just like, it was essentially Two Drink Mike on crack. And so the more I started writing it, the more I was like, you know, so much of what I'm writing is just about jokes and about comedy itself and about why we laugh and what's special about it and how comedy kind of makes us all in some ways feel closer to people. And that's why I named it Thank God for Jokes, you know, because I actually think that in some weird way, almost like a religion, I think that humor is like a uniting factor. Like, I feel like so often, like, when you talk to strangers, like, you can't really make a joke because it'll make things weird or awkward. But then if you do take a risk and go out on a limb and make a joke with someone, it actually can make you feel closer to them than you possibly could ever imagine.
Tell me something that you find inexplicably funny. There are explicably funny things, and then there are things that just doesn't make sense, but you will die laughing every time you see this or it happens.
Well, I think the funniest jokes are inside jokes. I think the funniest jokes are like, jokes you have with, like, jokes I have with my brother or my wife. Like, you know, like with my wife, for example, we laugh at so many things that no one thinks are funny other than me and my wife and our cat. Because when you have a cat, your barometer for humor is out the window. You know, earlier this year, I was like, we were going on a trip to Massachusetts, and I said, Ivan, that's our cat. I go, Ivan, we're going to Catsachusetts, which is not funny, but in our house was the joke of the year. I was like, we're going to Catsachusetts. My wife is like, ah. I was like, ah. Our cat's like, ah. And everyone loves a good pun when you have a cat. And we went to Catsachusetts, and we had this whole sort of run-in with a mouse and all this stuff. And it, honestly, there's a thing that I feel like you can't put your finger on, which is when you're close to someone, you have a shorthand for humor that requires very little, very few words. And I feel like that is sort of magical. I think that and I try to get that across in my show. My goal with Thank God for Jokes is to create a feeling where all, 1,000 people or so who are in the room together are experiencing this single inside joke all at the same time. And to me, that's a really special experience. So that's what I think is kind of magical about live comedy performance, is that kind of for that one night, all the people in the room are experiencing the same thing at the same time, and that's a special thing.
How do you deal with age differences, though? I mean, that's got to be kind of, because not only do people of different ages have different ideas about what constitutes comedy, i.e. my father is like, Carson, comedy. Letterman, not funny. You know?
Sure, yeah.
So how do you deal with that?
I've had this recently where I've been telling a story about the Muppets, and I performed at a college last week, WPI, and they didn't really know the Muppets.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, oh, no.
You're in your 30s. You're already getting the young people today don't understand.
Isn't that amazing? I couldn't believe it. I mean, and they did a remake of it, or a recent Muppets movie, but apparently that didn't hit with the college-age kids because I had this whole thing about how I had to follow Fozzie Bear and about how Fozzie Bear is actually... he's a really good comedian, and even when he's not good, he's good because he's got that joke parachute catchphrase, waka, 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 which is like his get her done. And I did this whole thing, it's a little bit on deaf ears with college students. And so it's a challenge, you always have to look for the human aspect of what you're writing. You always have to go, okay, if that doesn't connect with people of all ages, then what part of the story does connect?
Well, I also think there's the Jim Henson Muppets and the post-Jim Henson Muppets, and
very different.
Those of us of a certain age, you're right. There's just no comparison.
Yeah.
So, I guess you did Carnegie Hall. What was that like?
I did. It oddly was everything that I would hope that it would be. I feel like nothing in my life lives up to the expectations that I have for them. But that one was exciting. And then I gave out, I handed out free ice cream in the street to 2,000 people after the show. Me and Ira Glass and Anna Bass and Monica Bill Barnes, who perform with Ira, they're dancers who perform with Ira. And they opened up the show. And then afterwards, we handed out ice cream. We wore these sort of like ice cream, the old timey ice cream kind of like custard hats.
Oh my gosh.
And handed out ice cream in the street. And I can't tell you how happy people are when you perform a comedy show for them and then give them ice cream. It was a magical experience. And then my parents came, which was nice because they don't come to a whole lot of shows, but when you perform at Carnegie Hall, they don't have a lot of excuses. There's not much you can say to get yourself out of that one. so they came to the show, and it was a really special night. It was great.
Comedian Mike Birbiglia joined us by phone from New York. For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And today's program is Current State's first of our second year. We launched January 14th, 2013. Thanks to all of you for all the encouragement and constructive feedback over these 12 months. And if you have liked what you've heard, please consider a contribution to WKAR. It makes a difference. More information at WKAR.org. We also want to thank some people who don't get thanked enough. Gary Reed, Kim Geiger, Bill Richards, Katie Wolf and our comm team, Kathy Zell and everybody in fundraising, many thanks. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.